From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, our Week in Review probes the scandals at the state police and looks at the race for governor. Jay Gonzalez wants change.
I am not trying to become governor to manage the status quo.
But Governor Charlie Baker defended his tenure.
If I was a status quo governor, there'd still be thousands of homeless families living in hotels and motels in Massachusetts. There aren't.
Also today, we'll head back to City Hall Plaza for another check on Hub Week. And Fall River's 26-year-old mayor is facing charges of fraud.
His indictment just gives a big black eye to the city now.
Plus, the Red Sox start their series with the Astros tomorrow, hoping to make the World Series.
This is the playoffs. It's going to be a grind, you know. You're facing the lineup they were facing. It's not an easy lineup, you know. It only gets harder from here.
It's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz, and it's Friday, which for us means Week in Review, starting with the race for governor, you know, the person who oversees the government of Massachusetts. Incumbent Governor Charlie Baker met his challenger Jay Gonzalez for a first debate this week at Channel 4, where Baker pushed back against the charge that he's a status quo leader.
If I was a status quo governor, there'd still be thousands of homeless families living in hotels and motels in Massachusetts. There aren't. If I was a status quo governor, we wouldn't have a huge offshore wind and hydro program going on to replace a third of our fossil fuels with clean, renewable energy.
And Gonzalez kept repeating his response, that's just not enough.
It's not nearly enough. That's not an ambitious agenda. There's so much more we need to do to make a difference for working families in this state. And our transportation system is the thing I hear the most about everywhere I go. I will provide the bold leadership we need to fix it.
Joining us this week to talk about the contest and lots of other things Massachusetts is Shira Center, political editor at the Boston Globe and someone who has in the past saved me from making embarrassing errors in my own Globe pieces. How you doing, Shira?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me on the show. It's great to see you here.
It's great to be sitting here with you. Also with us is Michael Jonas, executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Michael, great to have you too.
Good to be here.
Hope you don't feel outnumbered by the Globies at the table.
No.
I'm happy
to be here with everyone.
Okay, so the short version is, at least of the debate, Baker presents himself as an effective administrator, someone who's improved the T, improved programs for the homeless, held the line on taxes. Gonzalez pushed for big programs, big spending, and attacked the governor for thinking too small. Shira, what'd you take away from the debate?
Well, the takeaway for me and, you know, the 10 other people who watched it during the Red Sox game, I thought it was a really civil and engaging debate. It was actually a nice reminder of what maybe democracy should look like. Often when incumbents are 20 points ahead and maybe more in the polls, they'll only debate their opponent once. And I'm certainly not saying that's a good thing, but that's a strategy some incumbents employ. And in this case, Charlie Baker signed up for three debates. And the debate, the most recent one with him and Jay Gonzalez, was a nice civil discourse. It was like, oh, a nice reminder of what politics is sort of supposed to be like in normal times.
If only the Sox weren't playing and people knew about that. Michael, what'd you think?
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I thought, one little interesting wrinkle, it was shown on C-SPAN, and I was thinking, not to be all sort of Pollyanna-ish or gauzy about Massachusetts, but I thought it really showed, as Shira was saying, it showed the state well to the country in the sense that it was very substantive. I mean, I think the problem, I think like a lot of people, I thought they both acquitted themselves well. I'd kind of call it a draw. I think the problem for Jay Gonzalez is we've got less than a month to go. And at this point, if you think of it like kind of a 100-yard dash, you know, Charlie Baker starts on the 40-yard line. Mm-hmm. And that's
so
the problem for Gonzalez.
So a draw wasn't good enough for Gonzalez.
Yeah, I mean, a draw means he's still behind. So, you know, there was no big, apologies for the baseball sort of references. There was no big home run, you know, by anyone. Or a big, stumble coming around third. I don't know. I'm running out of baseball
references. I guess
baseball
is just on everybody's mind this time of year.
And so in that way, I thought, you know, again, I think the Baker people have to probably be pretty happy with it.
Well, there was another line of attack that Gonzalez tried. That's the Jeff Diehl factor, right? Yeah. Diehl's the controversial former co-chair of Trump's 2016 campaign in Massachusetts, and he's the Republican candidate running against Elizabeth Warren for Senate. Here's Gonzalez.
By backing Jeff Diehl, Governor Baker is supporting an anti-choice agenda as well as an anti-LGBTQ, pro-NRA agenda. And I'm curious, Governor, why you have supported Jeff Deal.
Now, Baker has a technical response that he committed to supporting the full Republican slate before he knew that Deal would be the nominee.
Although he usually just calls it the ticket. He
doesn't
call it the Republican ticket.
The
right?
ticket.
Don't say that word.
Exactly, right?
Well, and then so that's the technical response. There's also the substantive response that he has openly opposed much of the Trump agenda.
My views on Donald Trump are quite well known. I didn't vote for him, and I've made quite clear my view on what I think about many of his positions and many of his policies. And he's not running. I'm running for governor, not Jeff Deal.
So, Shira, is this a line of attack that can work for Gonzalez?
It's a tough sell for a lot of Massachusetts voters. We polled with Suffolk University a couple of weeks ago about this very matter, how much Baker as a Republican can be tied to technically the leader of his party, Donald Trump. And 60%, actually just over 60% of respondents in our survey viewed Baker as anti-Trump as a candidate, which is so interesting, I think, especially even in Massachusetts, even for a Republican in Massachusetts. I thought it was it's notable. So it's a tough attack, but for Gonzalez, it may be one of the only things that has shown that can move the needle on it.
But it is interesting. Baker gets to keep that R next to his name, and yet people view him as anti-Trump. Michael, how does he pull this off?
I mean, I think there's still a sense. I mean, governors are really sort of out of the fray of the Washington fights. And when there have been fights there, as you're saying, I mean, you know, he was on the other side from the Republicans on the Affordable Care Act and other big issues. So I think people just are kind of giving him a little bit of a pass on the Deal thing. I mean, you know, I suppose he could be really mavericky and say he's going to, you know, stay neutral in that race. But that's not really Charlie Baker's style. And so, you know, he kind of, you know, very quietly says, I'm with the ticket. I don't think you're going to see him make appearances with Deal. You know, he's hoping that that's sort of the end of it. And I don't think voters are really, he doesn't seem like he's going to pay a big price for that.
You were going to say something, Shira.
If I can say, part of it, I think, is a history in Massachusetts of electing Republican governors who are maybe a little more mild-mannered, right? It draws such a contrast to Trump, Trump's being bombastic, especially during debates. So I think Massachusetts voters, in a way, are sort of used to this, attuned to this. And the other thing that's so striking, too, it's like whenever Baker gets on a stage or at a press conference or behind a podium, you're just reminded purely in his demeanor how different he is from the president. And I think a lot of Massachusetts voters see that and makes it a difficult sell. That said, Trump is the Massachusetts is the state that gives Trump the lowest marks out of every other state, except for the District of Columbia.
Presumably it hurts him with Trump voters. Does that matter? I mean, there were a million of them in the state. Does that make any difference at this stage, or with the primaries over, who cares? Michael?
I think it makes a little bit of a difference. And I think that, you know, I mean, Baker threw a little red meat to the base at the state party convention way back in the summer, if people can even remember that. So I think he's, you know, he's a little bit nervous about going too far and alienating those folks who are obviously not going to go to Gonzalez, but they could stay home.
35% of Republican primary voters chose Scott Lively, right?
Right.
There's an element of that there in the party.
It's a non-trivial number. I mean,
it is not trivial. Yeah. And I'm betting we did not survey them. I don't know for sure. But a lot of Republicans viewed that as an anti-Baker vote. This is mostly anecdotal, right? But it viewed it as more of an anti-Baker vote than even a pro-Lively vote.
But do they just kind of send him a message with that and then reluctantly trudge in and vote for him? Or do they do something more and, you know, and blanket? That's the worry, I guess, that they do have.
Well, imagine that instead of political journalists, your political advisors.
Uh-oh.
What would you tell? There's a reason we're not, right? There are other people who have this skill. But if we were, what would you tell Gonzalez? Is there anything he can do to gain traction in this race? Shira, you first.
Oh, I feel like I cannot answer that in my day job. I don't know. It is a tough race, right? This is an age in 2018, in the wake of the polling fiascos of 2016, you never want to trust polls anymore, right? You're inclined to always look at them so skeptically.
Not just 2016. We had the issue with Ayanna Pressley. That poll was a little bit out of date, and it really underestimated her chances.
It did. So it's very, I accept that it's really difficult to survey. And so there are trends out there and movements out there that we are just not seeing from where we sit all the time. I completely accept that. That said, we're talking about the Real Clear Politics average of 35-point spread. It's a tough race, but, you know, there's a million analogies, and we've been proven wrong so many times in the last couple of years.
Michael?
I mean, I don't, you know, it'd be hard to advise him now what to do. I mean, one thing I've noticed is he hasn't spent a lot of time sort of bashing, you know, the Beacon Hill establishment, which, you know, at times that's been one one approach that people have taken to these statewide races. I mean, we know they're going to have to go in there and work with those. In fact, he's almost been the opposite. He's kind of suggested that, you know, his former boss, Deval Patrick, didn't really know how to get things done on Beacon Hill. So Gonzalez is trying a different tack, saying, I understand how things work there. So that you know, that's appealing, but it takes away from him that line of attack to say, you know, I'm going to sort of deal with the mess up there and the legislature, which, you know, as an institution polls very poorly. It's sort of the same with, you know, Congress. People like their own representative, but, you know, but as a whole, it's a pretty easy thing to sort of take target practice at.
Well, okay, let's shift gears a bit and talk about climate change. Okay, shift gears a lot and talk about climate change, but really what climate change means for Greater Boston, because the global news is bleak. The UN released a major report this week saying that the world needs to radically change its energy system within 10 years or risk ecological and social disaster. We're talking food shortages, wildfires, die-off of coral reefs within the next 10, 15 years. Here's Jim Ski, co-chair of the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change.
The pledges that governments have made over the last 3 years are not enough to keep warming below 1.5 degrees C, even with ambitious and very challenging efforts after 2030.
Translation, it's bad and it's not getting any better, and that includes the potential of flooded streets in downtown. Michael, what's your read on how the city, the state, is handling climate change?
I mean, I think most people give Boston a pretty good grade. I think that we've been, I don't know, ahead of the curve. I know there's been also, it's remarked that we've kind of dodged the bullet so far, and we haven't, you know, seen sort of one of these climate related catastrophes yet, but we're probably due for it. You know, to do the sort of sweeping kind of preparation is just also like multiple billions of dollars proposition. So I think for any region, that's sort of a, you know, there's a big gulp that comes with how you're going to take that on. On the other hand, there's some stuff that we can be more proactive on. I thought there was actually a pretty good op-ed that ran in the Globe recently by the dean of the McCormick School at UMass Boston and someone who runs an entity there called the Sustainable Solutions Lab, Rebecca Hurst. And they said one thing that we could do at least is sort of take a more regional approach so that, you know, in the same way that we did when we established the MWRA or that we've dealt with our electrical grid. That we need sort of a regional approach, since the floods and the effects are not going to respect municipal boundaries. So that's one kind of process approach. But
yeah, and there are local leaders saying that Boston needs to take dramatic steps, regional or otherwise. Like John Cleveland, he's executive director of the Boston Green Ribbon Commission.
We have to decarbonize the grid. We have to electrify almost everything, including our heating, cooling, and transportation. And we have to dramatically reduce the demand for energy and individual cars.
Just that. No, nothing more than that.
Yeah, that's nothing. Just a few things tick off the to-do list.
Yeah,
you know?
Are you sure? What's your take on how the city, the state is handling this challenge?
Well, I think the city and the state, they're sort of different cases, but I think they're looking at it. I mean, this climate report says that no one is doing this nearly fast enough, right? What's striking to me is how much of the blame a lot of the study put on coal, which for the most part is not an industry that the state is known for, but yet we in Boston are the ones who are going to feel the effects of continued use of coal throughout the country, especially the middle of the country. So I think it's an interesting problem. There's been talk, obviously, about this $11 billion seawall in the harbor, and eventually they decided that was they've come to terms that it's probably not the best idea, that they want to look at these sort of smaller projects, but we're going to feel it sooner rather than later. And in many ways, this could be one part of Marty Walsh's legacy as mayor of Boston the next couple years, right? Is how he sets up the city during this pivotal time to be resilient against the forces of climate change and most notably flooding. I mean, last January, if that's a preview, remember, of the storms and the flooding in the harbor, that's a preview of things to come. It's scary.
Yeah. On the environment, Baker said last night that he's failed to meet his own pledge of 1% spending on environmental issues. He said it's only been about 0.5%. That's of total budgetary spending. This is how he put it.
I apologize for not delivering on my promise.
The only caveat I could offer on that, well, I'm not even going to go there. I apologize for not delivering on my commitment. I don't like not delivering on commitments that I make.
That was at the Museum of Science forum last night, where he just acknowledged he hasn't delivered on this commitment. He's sorry about that. Gonzalez has made a similar pledge.
By not later than the end of my first term, we will dedicate 1% of the state budget to environmental agencies. And we will make meaningful progress each year until we get there. That is a commitment of mine you can count on.
So I guess I'm circling back to the governor's race in a way here, but that's part of the question.
We don't mind.
Is this something that's at stake in the governor's race, Massachusetts' preparation for climate change? Cheerio.
I think it's an issue that Democrats and liberals like to talk about. I think you are in Massachusetts, compared to a whole lot of other states, you find a lot of environmentally focused voters. Is the question of will it be the decision maker for the 55% or so of independent voters out there? I don't know. I don't necessarily see that in these times, but it's still a major issue, and it's going to just continue to be, I think, a growing issue. Mm.
And how's this for a segue? You can grade me. From the destruction of the planet to the destruction of state records.
Oh, yes? Very good.
All right.
10 out of 10.
Let's talk about ongoing scandals at the Massachusetts State Police. 2018 has been a year of state police scandals, from fake overtime claims to charges of political favoritism. Two former state police commanders were in court today denying the charges of overtime abuse. Yesterday, another trooper pleaded guilty to embezzlement in federal court. And WBUR broke the story this week that the agency sought permission to destroy documents, some dating back decades, that could be essential to future investigations. Michael, what did you make of the most recent twist in this story?
What I made of it was that was a horrible look for the state police. And there's just no other way to look at it. There was, I guess, technically the request to destroy records, complied with all the regulations around how old they have to be and so forth. But, you'd have to be crazy to not realize there's a broader context at the moment with these investigations. And, the governor came out and said this shouldn't be done. They shouldn't be seeking these. But I think there's still a lot of question about, there were three different requests submitted by three different people. I mean, what prompted those requests? Was there anyone higher up on the food chain that had to approve them, or that maybe initiated the requests? And is there any accountability now for how that happened? I mean, we need kind of a deconstruction of how this came about. It's not enough that we just know that this records board denied the requests and cited the ongoing investigations. I think there is still, it doesn't smell good.
Well, you mentioned the governor's comment on it. Let's listen to that.
What they did was completely consistent with standard operating procedure. They shouldn't be destroying payroll records. They shouldn't be operating under standard operating procedure at this point in time, given everything else that's going on with respect to the state police and payroll.
And since I can't get away from the governor's race, let's also listen to Jay Gonzalez's response, which was sharper.
The colonel should be fired. The secretary of public safety should be fired. The governor should appoint someone to lead his state police who's going to root out corruption, someone from the outside who's got credibility.
Shira, is this the governor's fault, or should we think more broadly about what's going on behind this? Lack of oversight, cultural problems at the state police. How do you see responsibility?
I think in terms of voters, if there's one major issue where the candidates are split on in terms of recent news, it's this one, right? Because Charlie Baker has clearly stood by Colonel Carrie Gilpin throughout this. Jay Gonzalez has said she and many others need to go, right? This is certainly a difference. There's
so
a
that's
whole
a very
lot of
concrete distinction.
Absolutely, between the two candidates. And I think it's an issue and an opportunity, actually, for Jay Gonzalez to get a lot of traction. Charlie Baker has cited in several of his responses about the ongoings in this incident that it's happened prior to his time. It was established before his time. And our editorial board noted this morning that they don't think that's good enough anymore. He's been in office for 3.5 years.
Yeah, we have the quote, actually, I have in front of me from the Globe editorial. Baker's the boss now, which means the buck stops with him. Under this governor, the state police clearly thought they could get away with blatantly inappropriate behavior. How extremely disappointing. You go on, I just...
No, I mean, that's obviously our editorial board, which is separate from our news department. But the governor certainly has an issue with this here. And it's a political issue as much as it is a state issue.
Michael, do you have a sense for where this should start if the problem is going to get fixed?
I mean, you know, it's hard to know whether Gilpin, you know, I mean, Gonzalez says, you know, the sort of, you know, the fish rots from the head down. Even though she's newly appointed, he thinks there needs to be a change in leadership and someone brought in from the outside. So I'm not sure about that. I mean, the other thing that I would just note is that, you know, when there are problems that come up anywhere in government, that's not good. But there is a particularly corrosive effect of corruption within law enforcement. And that's something that, you know, I think you can't emphasize enough. There's been a lot of talk about
corrosive in what way?
I mean, just in terms of public confidence in government. I mean, these are the people who, you know, enforce norms of behavior on all of us. And yet, if this is what's going on within the department, I mean, it just undermines, I don't want to sound too dramatic, it undermines the whole premise of the rule of law, but at some point it does.
I agree. These are the people who give you speeding tickets, right? These are the people who a lot of citizens have the most interaction with, right? Or hopefully not have the most interaction with, I should say.
But it is one aspect where you touch upon government in your daily life. They're following you on the highway if you're speeding, things like that.
Right. You see cops at intersections. You see it all. So I think it really has a pervasive effect in the way other issues don't.
And do you think it is improving? Do you think the charges brought are making a difference? Or do you think, no, in fact, we're just at the beginning of fixing this? Michael?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know how much more there is to be be discovered. I mean, I think we're in that phase where it doesn't look good, but it's kind of the cleansing process that you have to go through to get to a better place on the other end of it all. So, you know, hopefully, you know, things are getting better by the sort of sunlight being, flashing on what's going on there and the kind of cases and investigations running their course.
All right. Well, maybe let's end with some lighter news than the corruption that corrosively undermines faith in government. Hubbubs. Everybody loves a hubbub. The brief stories or events that didn't get a lot of general attention but caught your attention this week. Shira, what jumped out at you?
Well, this got some attention, but I thought it was such a fun idea that I wanted to bring it up. British developer Scape has plans to build $1 billion in privately run dorms, 5 buildings, up to 3,000 beds for essentially college students. And they wouldn't be exclusive to a single school. They'd be these towers where students, mostly upperclassmen, they say gravitate towards these, would be housed in one building. And it just sounded like a fun community. That could be here in the city and alleviate not only problems for college students who unfortunately because of budget constraints end up living in conditions that are not always up to par, and also for the city, which is having a housing crunch. Right, it opens up has the potential to open up some housing for the workforce instead of the student force. My one thought is, the story noted that this company looked for 18 months for a spot in America to open up their first dorm. I'm like, it took you 18 months to find Boston? What?
We're here.
We have so many college students.
No, but they're not the only ones struggling to get permission to build buildings in America.
This is true.
Michael, your hubbub?
So mine is something that has actually been building for a while, but actually will kind of come with a bang tomorrow. So we're looking ahead a little bit, and that is tomorrow, Artists for Humanity, which is was founded as a small nonprofit back in 1991, will celebrate the opening of a new addition to its Epicenter, which is its main building in South Boston. And this will double to more than 500 the number of Boston teens that it serves through what is a really cool model of paid mentoring of young people in art and design fields. It's an amazing program. It's great that they're going to be able to serve so many more kids. As their name says, Artists for Humanity, more art, more humanity. What could be wrong with that?
Who's opposed to that?
Exactly.
All right, my hubbub then. The Boston Dynamics robot. I don't know if you've seen these videos. If you haven't, you must. For a couple of years, this company, this local company, Boston Dynamics, has been training this android robot that looks like a person, that has 2 legs, 2 arms, torso. And the early videos are kind of cute. They teach it to walk a little bit, and it stumbles. Well, this week they released a video in which it does parkour. Which is not like training a little child to walk. It's like watching your future robot overlords teach you how human bodies could move if they were only powered by machines. It was fascinating, harrowing glimpse into our future.
Maybe they'll save us from climate change.
Well, that's something. Michael Jonas is executive editor of Commonwealth Magazine. Thanks, Michael, for coming in.
Thank you.
And Shira Center, political editor at the Boston Globe. Thank you as well.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, we'll check in today with Radio Boston's Chris Sidorek down at City Hall Plaza for Hub Week. I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz, and I'm ready to flit over to City Hall Plaza, where Hub Week is underway. That's Boston's Festival for the Future. Radio Boston's Chris Sidorek is there and eager to talk to us. Chris, how's it going?
Hey, Evan. We're here at the WBUR booth. We're set up right next door to the center stage area, so there's lots of folks milling around, people just leaving to talk or coming for the next presentation. We're right across the plaza from the Hall of the Future, so we're right here in the middle of the action.
It's funny. I know you're far away. I feel like I have to shout into the microphone, but probably that doesn't make a difference. Anyway, I don't have your view.
No, that's the magic of radio, my friend.
I don't have your view, but I gather there's a lot to see there. Can you give us a taste?
There is a lot to see down here, and you're crazy if you think I didn't jump on one of those demo VR headsets immediately when I got here.
That's what I would do.
Yeah. There's also an art exhibition called We the Future set up, about a dozen or so large shipping containers. I walked through one of those. It was called Neon Dreams Crystal Cave, this really cool, glowing, fluorescent cavern made out of these tiny 3D crystals that were actually made out of paper and then hand-stitched together. Pretty cool to see. There's also a bunch of 3D printed clothes. There's brainstorming walls everywhere, lots of different topics for people to share some ideas and connect. And I know Jamie Bologna, who was here covering the event for us yesterday, got a kick out of the wax figures of Bill Gates and Steve Jobs. You can let him know that Mark Zuckerberg has joined that crew.
Oh, add Zuckerberg, wax Zuckerberg.
Wax Zuckerberg, that's right. There's also lots of interesting conversations going on covering a wide range of topics, everything from energy-efficient cities to how our culture thinks about voting, to depression and brain health, to how we can best utilize self-driving cars. So really a lot of variety, and people seem really excited to connect and share their ideas.
I'm embarrassed to say that the thought that came into my head about Festival for the Future, because apparently I'm old enough that my vision of the future involves a TV show from 30 years ago, but I'm just interested in whether we're ever going to get the robots from the Jetsons, because yesterday our colleague Jamie Bologna spoke with Ty Brady from Amazon Robotics, who said this.
I think in robotics we're in the very early innings. If it were a baseball game, it would probably be the first batter. It might even be the first couple pitches. I mean, it's that early. It's not until recently it has this confluence of computing and sensors and connectivity has come about, and this has given age to in what I view as a golden era of robotics that we're just about to embark upon. So it's super exciting because it's so early, and we think that we can shape that in a way to make the Amazon customer experience even better.
So, Chris, that's Ty Brady from Amazon Robotics saying we're at the beginning, but maybe headed to something great? What do you make of
that? Yeah, I'm sorry to disappoint you. I haven't seen any Jetson-style flying cars that fold into a briefcase.
That is exactly what I want.
I understand. We all do. But it is funny you mentioned the Jetsons, because I did see something pretty futuristic over in, I guess, fittingly called the Hall of the Future. It was a demo setup called The Future of the Smart Home. And it's basically set up this sleek, clean kitchen and living room with chairs and tables. And there's this large bureau desk combo unit that was about 6 feet tall, maybe 4 feet wide. And as I was standing in front of the display, it suddenly just started moving by itself, slowly gliding across the living room floor. And as it moved, a bed slid out the back, the idea being basically that the home can turn the living room into a bedroom to help maximize space. Seemed pretty crazy to me, pretty out there for a home to be filled with self-moving furniture, but I'm actually here with someone now who says we're maybe a year or two away from our homes thinking and moving on their own. And that's Colin Engel. He's the co-founder and CEO of iRobot. Colin, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So you led a discussion earlier today on the center stage called Living at Home with Robots, and you guys talked about a new development in the concept of a smart home that you're calling Spatial Context. Can you tell us a little bit about that and why you feel this could be so transformational?
Sure. So, you know, trying to make a robot intelligent is really hard. But it's not hard for reasons that you might think. I mean, AI can understand things that, you know, if you talk to a Google assistant and say, hey, what's the temperature outside today? It'll parse the words go to the internet, find the answer, and come back. But if you say, hey, Google, can you turn on the lights in the kitchen? The problem is we don't know what the kitchen is, and so, or where the kitchen is, or what's in the kitchen. And so even if you understand the words, it's hard to know what to do. And that's changing. And the what we're trying to show in the Hall of the Future in our smart home is a different way to think about technology in the home, where the home is smart enough to understand what it's supposed to do based on where you are, what you're doing, and what you might ask. So if you walk into the living room, well, the lights in the living room should turn on, the heating should adjust. If you say, turn on the TV, the right TV should turn on, not the TV in the bedroom. And the house should be automatically responding to you. And I think that we're pretty close to that. One of the things that you now can do, and this is only a few weeks old, is if you make a mess in the living room, you could say, hey, okay, Google, clean the floor in the living room. And now we have a robot that will actually do that because it understands where the rooms are. It'll turn itself on, come to the living room, and do its job.
So how would you compare that to kind of the idea of what we think of now as a smart home? Maybe I can do my thermostat from my phone or those types of things.
So I think today that the smart home is a collection of a lot of stuff. And I think for a while companies thought, hey, I'll add a wireless chip to my whatever it is, refrigerator or thermostat or speaker or light bulb, and I'll create an app on my phone. And I can turn on the lights in the room by pulling the phone out of my pocket, turning that on, unlocking it, starting the app, waiting for the app to connect. And
or you can flip the switch.
30 seconds later, you can turn on the light. All right, or you could flip the switch. And
right.
I think what has become clear is that's wrong. That's, like, really wrong. We need the house to turn the light on automatically just because it understands that you're in a situation right now where you'd really like that light to be on.
So what's the biggest challenge to do that? Because you say, okay, now we have a vacuum that knows what the kitchen is. To your average person, that doesn't seem like that complicated a concept. So what is the challenge there?
One of the big challenges of robotics is we people are really good robots. We have all this understanding of the environment already, and, you know, we're in the kitchen, we know we're in the kitchen. But robots, like the mechanical kind of robots, are really stupid. They don't have any of this knowledge pre-programmed in. They didn't grow up and learn about different rooms. They're, you know, bits and things. So what we had to do was first build the technology so that the robots can recognize landmarks. So as the robot's moving around, it's like, okay, I know what that is. I know what that is. Okay, corner of chair, I know what that is. Okay, I know where I am. And then build from landmarks and the ability to figure out sort of X, Y, Z on a map where you are, move around and create a map of where the space is. And then from the map of the space, okay, how do I divide up that space into rooms? And then the next time I turn on to go do the job, keeping track of where on that map I am so I know which room I'm in at any time.
I'm curious about that concept. Kitchen is, it might know where its kitchen is, but could it eventually be extrapolated to understand what, if you take it into a different home, oh, this mm-hmm. is a kitchen because there's a stove and a fridge and that sort of thing.
I mean, I think that's where things will go.
Down the road.
Down the road. Right now, what we do is we show you your floor plan, we guess where it's likely rooms are, and then you can go edit that map, little push a wall here or a divider here, and then name the rooms, because kitchens might be recognizable, but if you call the playroom the den, it's going to be a long time before we have AI that can figure that out. So,
hey, Chris, do you mind if I cut in and ask a question?
How you doing? Go right ahead, Evan.
Hey, Colin.
Hey.
So sometimes it seems to me like the futuristic stuff on offer isn't always the stuff people most want or need. Like moving furniture around, that sounds very cool. But what I'm looking for is robots that will fold my laundry and do dishes. I mean, like, the dishwasher was a major innovation. Like, there have been major innovations in ending drudgery. And I wonder if we're close to another of those.
Right. So, you know, the industry is progressing. And we started off with things that we thought we could do at a price point that was lower than the value that the service was. And that's good business. You can sell, you know, we sold over 20 million robots. And last year, the Roomba vacuum cleaner was actually the number one selling vacuum cleaner in the United States, which is like, woohoo, we got one. Now, you asked about folding laundry and things that require arms. And this idea that understanding the home is critical for the advancement of robotics, I think that that's a great example, because what's the point of having arms on a robot if you don't know where anything is? So that, you know, the all-important go to the kitchen and get me a beer is an irrelevant or an impossible request if I don't know where the kitchen is and don't know where the refrigerator is. But and so that this idea of, okay, technology has gotten to the point where we can understand where a room is. So that's like a big deal. That's like the beginning of understanding enough about the home to go at arms. Understand local...
So I like, you know, this idea of the importance of understanding as building on technology. It does make me wonder how much we have to give up about ourselves and our privacy to make it all work. That is, how much do the robots really have to know about our homes and our lives before they can be useful? And are you concerned that we're giving up so much about our private spaces?
Well, you know, I think that if you want the robot to clean the kitchen, it needs to know what the kitchen is to some degree, meaning the bounds and so forth. It doesn't need a picture of the kitchen. It doesn't need a ton of detail. And we can do that. And again, this is something that as a consumer, if you want this, I think you need to know two things. One, what am I going to get for it? Okay, robot is going to be able to clean the kitchen when, without giving this information, it can't. And second, is the company that you're giving that information to going to treat that information in a respectful way, using best practice to try to ensure that that information is held secure? And so, you know, iRobot is investing continuously, aggressively in privacy and security, and we tell you what you're going to get for sharing the data. And if you don't want to do that, well, then the Roomba can't clean your kitchen. It'll just clean the whole house. And maybe that's okay. But this partnership between benefit and confidence is a trade-off we have to continually look at.
That's Colin Angle, co-founder and CEO of iRobot. Colin, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
Back to you in the studio, Evan.
Thanks so much, Chris. That's Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. The very young, very energetic mayor of Fall River is now very much under indictment. It's not exactly a tale of political corruption because it's not about Mayor Jaisal Correa's time in office. Instead, it's about a company he used to run where he allegedly took hundreds of thousands of dollars from investors to finance his own, quote, lavish lifestyle, end quote. Here's Hank Shaw, the FBI special agent in charge.
Mayor Correa has brought undeserved shame and embarrassment upon the city of Fall River. He betrayed the trust of his investors and betrayed the trust of his constituents.
For now, Correa remains defiant. He's back at work today, having pled not guilty on all charges.
I've done nothing wrong. If you look at my track record as mayor, all you see is positive results.
Here for with us for reaction in Fall River is Will Richmond. He's the city editor at the Herald News. Hi, Will.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I'm all right. You're at the epicenter of this. I mean, people around the state are just kind of waking up to this story, but you guys have had an inkling that something was up for some time, yes?
Yes, we've been following this this issue for quite a while now, since shortly after the mayor initially took office 3 years ago. So it's something that, you know, we've been looking for this day to come, and you know, certainly been waiting to see if this indictment would eventually come down, which certainly happened yesterday.
So Correa, he's charged with fraud and filing false tax returns, and it has to do with a company of his called Snow Owl. Can you tell us what Snow Owl is and what this scheme was all about?
Sure. The Snow Owl was an app being developed by Jaisal Correa. It was the intent of it was to match businesses to people as they came into an area. So essentially, if you visited a new city, you could plug this app in and connect with restaurants or other businesses that would be nearby to you.
And what was he doing that drew the attention of law enforcement?
Hey, there were a number of investors, I guess seven in total, who had put over $300,000 into the company. It turned out, as they're alleging, the mayor had used most of that money, about 64%, to fund what they termed his lavish lifestyle, spending this money on a Mercedes-Benz, luxury hotels, airfare, travel, and even adult entertainment. You know, during this time, he had told his investors he did not intend to take a salary during the development of the app. But in the end, none of the investors saw any return on their investment, and it seems the mayor was using that money to further his personal lifestyle and even his political campaign.
Did that stand out? I mean, the Mercedes, the lavish lifestyle. I mean, Fall River, right? Fall River is a city where the poverty rate is over 20%. The household income is about half the statewide average. Did the mayor's, did people recognize that there was something out of character about the mayor's lifestyle?
Not necessarily. He was known as an ambitious person in the city. Even as a teenager, he stood out and was recognized by leaders in the city for his leadership of groups that were involved in anti-drug campaigns and that sort of thing. Certainly, you know, for a while he was driving the Mercedes, but he explained it as that he had sold an app when he was in college, and that was where he had gotten the money from. There were also explanations that his mother had co-signed, and he was leasing the Mercedes. But other than that, you know, there was nothing outstandingly flashy about him. He liked to wear nice clothes, especially once he took over as mayor. As a college student, he worked at Nordstrom's in Providence, and so you know, he wasn't viewed as being extravagantly flashy.
So
he
denied all charges, and he's pledged not to resign. Does he have the support in the community to stay in office? So how are the people of Fall River feeling about this?
Well, most of the people we spoke to yesterday found that they were not happy with what happened. You know, there were some who called it an embarrassment for the city. There were others who were immediately calling for his resignation. Most of the people who hold elected positions or even official type roles in the city suggested that the mayor should either step aside or just flat out resign at this point. And there are many councillors as well who are now angling to take a vote of no confidence in him next week.
Well, I guess we'll see how this unfolds. That's Will Richmond. He's the city editor at the Herald News in Fall River. Thanks so much, Will.
All right. Thanks for having me.
There's only one thing stopping the Red Sox from returning to the World Series, the Houston Astros. But watch out, they're really, really good. Here's Red Sox manager Alex Cora on the Astros, the team he was the bench coach for just last year.
It seems like they're playing their best baseball of the season at the right time. They can pitch, they're playing good defense, they're swinging the bat well, they're a complete team. I've been talking about them the whole season, so now we go.
Game one is tomorrow at Fenway Park for this best-of-seven series. Steve Buckley joins me to provide some expert thoughts on what the Sox need to win and how they might blow it. Steve's a columnist with The Athletic and a longtime Red Sox observer. Steve, welcome back to the program.
It's good to be here.
It's
interesting days we live in.
Aren't they, though? From mayors to the World Series. I mean, it is a great baseball matchup, right? You've had two teams that both won 100 games, but in different ways. Right? The Red Sox scored more runs than anybody else. The Astros allowed fewer runs than anybody else. What do you expect to see when these two teams collide?
I think the most interesting, honest answer I could provide is I don't know, because it's almost a cliche, you know, when these two teams meet, anything can happen. But when these two teams meet, anything can happen. They are very good teams. The key thing to look for here, in my opinion, is the Red Sox starting pitching situation. My sixth sense tells me you have a David Price question in the back of your head to ask.
Well, yeah, it's and, there. That is, and, will David Price win a game?
And, well, statistically, he's due, you could say. I mean, that the bettors would say he's due. But the fact of the matter is he's made 10 postseason starts. He's 0-9 with a 6.03 ERA, which goes beyond Buzzard's luck. It just becomes a degree where he just never wins a postseason game as a starter. And he is starting game two. What the Red Sox need is for Chris Sale and David Price, their first two pitchers in the series, to go deep into the game, at least the sixth inning, because it takes the pressure off of what everyone agrees is a subpar bullpen. So if you can get later into the game, you're not bringing in flawed relief pitchers, and you get maybe to the ninth inning, and Kimbrel's the closer, had a rocky outing against the Yankees in the last game of the division series, but his overall numbers are outstanding.
Right. Across the season, Kimbrel's been lights out most of the season. But it's the rest of the bullpen that is kind of the weak link. If there is a weak link on the Red Sox team, it's the middle relief,
well,
the rest of the bullpen.
I call it an old-time bullpen to the degree that back in the day, there's never enough pitching. So your pitching staff would be your four best pitchers were your four starters. Then you got that closer who throws 96 miles an hour. And then the fifth starter was usually released by May because he wasn't that good. And then the bullpen, the so-called long guys, were just guys you picked up. They came and went. They were journeyman
players. Yeah.
Yeah, they'd come and go, and, you know, Alan Embry and guys like that. And then about 5 or 6 years ago, we began seeing a trend in baseball where bullpens were built kind of from the middle out. And you note that the Tampa Bay Rays are using what's called the opener now, which is a guy that pitches just the first inning, and then they kind of piece it together from there based on matchups.
It's one of the biggest strategic changes in baseball.
It's huge. And then the Royals won the World Series a few years back with middle relievers throwing 100 miles an hour. So if the starter was up in the fifth inning, usually you just, okay, we're done. We're all set here. We're going to win. And now the Royals bring in a guy that throws 101 miles an hour, and it's a whole different ballgame. So this, and I say it with a wink, is an old-time bullpen in which the middle guys are just flawed guys who will jump around.
So we talk about pitching, but if the Red Sox have an advantage, it's on the other. It's hitting. Like the Astros don't have a Mookie Betts-type hitter, right? They don't have a standout. Or who do you think of as the...
I think of Alex Bregman, yeah, just because I think he's going to put up big numbers. And Steve Springer is another one. They've got some hitters. Now, do they have the 1-2 MVP finalists as
right.
we think Boston's J.D. Martinez and Mookie Betts will be? No. But in the grand scheme of things, these are two powerful teams capable of lighting it up, and I think we're going to see lots of offense in this series.
Anything you had a few minutes with Alex Cora you would want to tell him to be particularly attentive to? That's the Red Sox manager.
I'd say be particularly attentive to David Price, considering that in the column in The Athletic, I slammed the gavel down and said that David Price must not make another start in the postseason. I thought they could have rescued him by moving him to the bullpen strategically, not just as a punishment, in that he pitched out of the bullpen in the playoffs last year, made two outstanding relief outings, albeit coming off of an injury, wasn't capable of going deep into the game, so they strategically said, let's just use him as a relief pitcher, but why not strategically use him in the same role this year, but for a different reason, that being they just don't think he can win games as a starter. So they've not chosen to take my advice.
I asked a version of this question to somebody else earlier in the week, but I'll ask you. It's a kind of pre-postmortem question. Let's say we invite you back in 10 days to talk about why the Red Sox lost. What do you think would be the reason?
That David Price lost two starts and that Houston pitching shut down J.D. Martinez and Mookie Betts.
Do you think that's going to happen, or do you think the Red Sox can actually take this, will actually take this?
I think they will, because I think that Martinez is locked in. I think Mookie's going to pick it up. I have confidence in the offensive thrust of this team. And not just the two big names, but also Xander Bogaerts and Andrew Benintendi and even like Ian Kinsler. They have some good young players on this team, and they're cohesive and they're powerful, and I think they're going to score a lot of runs.
Well, I guess we'll find out starting tomorrow. That was Steve Buckley, columnist for The Athletic. Thanks so much, Steve.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Zoe Mitchell, with help today from Eve Zuckoff and Kainat Khan. Tim Skog is our technical director. A special thanks to George Hicks and the WBUR engineering team for their help with Hub Week. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Evan Horowitz. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.